Good afternoon and welcome to Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the heartland of Santa Cruz. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM and online it's www.freakradio.org. And I'm going to be with you from 3 until 5 and I've got a great show lined up for you. In the first hour, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Darryl Babe Wilson. He was with us last week, and he is the author of Two Moon. And we're going to be discussing the difference between oral tradition and storytelling, and migration patterns, and much, much more. And before I begin, I just want to say a little bit about Darryl. He's an author, educator, and storyteller. And his website is Hiditsu Law. Hope I'm pronouncing that right. Is that Hiditsu correct? Hiditsu Law. And how do you spell that?
H-A-Y. Hey, it's like a bale of hay.
D-U.
Dutsi Law.
Dutsi Law.
Hey.
Dutsi Law.
Dutsi. Thinking. Refining. Law. The outcome of that thought.
Hey, Dutsi Law.
Hey, Dutsi
Law. Hey, Dutsi Law. Thank you. And also with us is his publisher, Mark Hager. And he's also an author, musician, and an event producer, and basically a general media consultant. And he's worked throughout the Bay Area. And he's also published a novel, Boom Backstage Pass, about the life behind the scenes of show business. And that has received critical acclaim. And welcome, Mark.
Thank you so much, Janaea. We're very happy to be here.
Thank you.
We're very much supportive, too, of Free Radio Santa Cruz and everything you guys are doing down here.
Well, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Always looking for donations.
Well, you heard that, everyone. Free radio doesn't happen by itself.
Mm-hmm.
So for bringing you great content, Janaea and Darryl here support the cause.
Thank you, Mark. And those can be mailed to FRSC P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz 95061. But I want to get started with Darryl. And I'm curious what you have to say about storytelling and oral tradition.
Well, first, could I say something about Darryl?
You certainly may.
Well, everybody else in my life calls me Babe. I'm named after Babe Ruth. So anyhow, that's what everybody calls me. Besides, Darryl is not my real name. That's my American name. My real name in my homeland is Somme Ejoti. Somme Ejoti. In the old way, males are named after the landscape where they were born.
Mm-hmm.
And I was born on the north side of a river called Somme Ejoti, which is in the Fall River Valley, and the river is called Fall River, but it's really Somme Ejoti.
Beautiful.
Okay, so, storytelling?
Okay. So the males were named after the landscape.
Yes, where they were born. If somebody was born at Rainbow Falls, like Grandpa Ramsey, then he would have a rainbow somewhere in his name. If somebody was born at Big Valley, then he'd have a Big Valley somewhere in his name. If somebody was born on top of Akuyet, Akuyet would be in the name.
It's such an intimate connection with the land.
That's to make sure that everybody knows exactly where they came from. Exactly. I mean, it's in the name. It's in the word. Somme Ejoti.
Somme Ejoti.
It's right there beside the river. You put your finger on it.
Somme Ejoti. That's beautiful.
It has a long, 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 long meaning, though. We can't talk about that. It'd take a whole show.
Well, next time. And Mark just wants to say a little bit about you as well.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
I just want the audience and Babe and everyone to know what an honor it is to work on his writing.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are very few original sources of wisdom left in the world. And the knowledge that he brings and that he has chosen to share is original source knowledge. This is material that you can't trace the beginning of it because it is untouched. Mm-hmm. Even though the process of oral tradition, and this is what Daryl will talk about here soon, the difference between storytelling and oral tradition, because we need to stress when it's oral tradition, it's original wisdom. And there can be a lot of wisdom, a lot of fun in storytelling, and a lot of, but in terms of what the world needs to hear right now, I think the most important part about Two Moon is that original wisdom always applies. Doesn't matter always. The age you're in. It doesn't matter the situation
Throughout
you're in.
Throughout the book.
This is always important. Everything that you bring to
Striking.
Us is so important, not only to ourselves now, but to the next generation, to our children, that there is a whole panoply of forces that come into play to support true wisdom. And Babe has talked about it, and I have experienced it, that when you start dealing with original material, you have deep, powerful forces that come both to challenge you and to aid you. And
well
so
said.
It's a great work, and it's an honor to be a part of it. And I think the readers will understand, Babe doesn't, as is the tradition in Native communities, he doesn't speak openly of himself. Often, but there's no question to me that the literary value of what he has done, beyond the value of the ancient pure wisdom and the fact that we're being given a window into an original truth, the literary value of what Babe has done is on par with Fine Deloria and M. Scott Momaday and all of the great in the genre. And beyond that, you know, I think there's even, it's even okay to talk about it as the great American work of art. I wouldn't call it a novel because it weaves so much, it's about his life and about the ancient tradition. But in terms of what this land is about and what the world we live in right now is about, I feel
originally
it is the great work.
That a lot of it has been hidden from us. And you write so eloquently, and you make it contemporary as well. It's gripping. Fascinating.
Thank you. Am I going to talk about storytelling now?
Certainly.
Thank you, Mark. You're very nice. I thought they were talking about somebody else.
See, that's the natural humility. That...
Anyhow, storytelling and oral literature. I taught oral literature classes at several colleges in the Bay Area, San Francisco State being one. But I'm not exactly an authority, although I live it every minute of the day. Storytelling, for instance, is very suggestive of something that is made up, something that somebody created in the back room and ran out and give you an answer for it. Storytelling. I asked my children about that, and they said, well, Dad, storytelling is what you do when a cop stops you and you run the stop sign. You tell him a story. And so storytelling is really a shallow kind of a thing. Oral literature, on the other hand, has ancient roots in the universe. The wisdom, the knowledge that comes to each generation, and it comes to each generation. A lot of generations are not prepared to receive it, but it does come. And it started when the earth started turning around the sun with that generation and the knowledge and the wisdom and the experience in that generation was passed to the next generation. The next generation added their wisdom and knowledge and experience and passed that to the next generation. So when, how many generations, nobody really has any idea, but an awful lot. and it comes as a truth that has to be received, as a truth. It's not storytelling. It's pure, absolute history. Mm-hmm. History of the world, history of the universe, history of song, history of dream, mm-hmm. history of wonder.
Yeah.
Everything else. And it comes in a nice little beautiful package when you're born. Mm. And it's a gift to everyone who is ready to receive it. And it is just like a fully charged battery.
Yeah.
I think some of these people who write about children being like a blank slate, we have to write on it. They probably started as a blank slate and assume somebody else's kid is too. That's not true.
No, it isn't.
Everybody is absolutely complete. In my case, complete with language and song, with three languages, native languages, and three sets of songs. But a person is not just born. A person is dreamed, and that's a fulfillment of an ancient dream that started so long ago. The mountains might have forgot about that, but here you come, and here you are, absolutely complete. You know, I watch education. I'm an educator, or I went to college to learn how to teach people something. And the best thing I found to teach people that something was to forget everything else they were ever taught and start right now. Whether it's English language or history, history is really a pile of worms and snakes.
The history is presently taught in most of our, well,
but the ancient knowledge that comes is not manufactured somewhere and read in another book somewhere mm-hmm. else, pieced together from somebody else's thought somewhere, somehow. It's just pure wisdom that comes, and everybody is absolutely complete, just like a little deer. And a little mm-hmm. deer, maybe you can't smell him, maybe you can't see him. But if it's a mountain lion around, and he wants to eat a little deer, and he's looking at the little deer, and makes eye contact with that little deer somehow, and he says, "There you are." And the little deer's got to jump up and run. He's got to duck and dive and squirm and everything else to get away. He can't just lay there. That's the way education says everybody is, laying there on a blank slate. You got to jump up and run from the mountain lion. But you're absolutely born complete. You know how to run. You know how to duck. You know how to dodge. You know why. You know where your safety is, and you know when you're safe, and you know when you got to run again so somebody looks behind the bush and finds you.
The instincts are right there.
So,
I'd like to point out the difference, too, in the oral history, where when we create history in books, mm-hmm. we turn out endless quantities of, like you say, worms, piles of worms. We turn out just book after book after book, textbook. There's no end. Mm-hmm. But when you have an oral history, mm-hmm. there is a process where each time that story is learned, each time it's passed on, that mm-hmm. wisdom, mm-hmm. it has to be absorbed or it's not passed on. It has to be a living history so that the process, in our structured Western view of history, we say that that's an inferior process because that someone will add something or change anything, but in reality, there are ways in which it is an inherently superior process, because each new storyteller, each babe that mm-hmm. comes along to mm-hmm. hold the story, has to live and know the truth of that wisdom. And therefore, everything that is passed on has gone through this vetting process, mm-hmm. where what's left is the kernel, the truth. And the story that carries it isn't the point, it's the knowledge, the wisdom that's there.
Excellent point.
I was going to say something.
Go ahead.
That the knowledge and wisdom that came to me started when I was just still in the womb. and the elder people talking to me, talking into my mother's belly, and there I was, listening to him. And after that, and then had chances to go and talk with the oldest people in the whole country. And they might be sitting under a tree somewhere, might have been sitting there for a week, who knows, but to tell you a story. Mm-hmm. And it's somehow sticks. And then somebody 10 years later will repeat that story. And I said, oh, I know that one. They told it exactly, not exactly word for word, verbatim, like it was, but all of the contents are there. Not defiled, not slanted. Nobody changed the date.
Yeah.
History, everybody runs out and changes something. It's not like that. It accumulation, it, just like wisdom and knowledge accumulated coming through the stars, accumulation from when I was in a birth, when I was in the womb, until I was out of high school. Mm-hmm. Off and on. Important information came to me. Important knowledge came to me.
To living in the world with all of our relations, connecting deeply. And you write in Two Moon about being with your mother and her friends, your aunts, when they were picking roots, they were root digging, and they were sharing stories. And you just, it was like a process of osmosis. You just took in the stories. You remember it
the
so clearly.
Ladies digging roots, and long ago they go, the whole tribe would go. And I was hanging in an oak tree on a baby basket.
That's what it was. Yeah, I wasn't sure if that's what it was,
and
or where you were.
The wind blew me this way, and the wind blew me back. So I just dangled there, hanging in the wind, moving back and forth, watching people work and dig roots. And the elder ladies would come run back to camp for a drink of water or something. And, you know, old ladies always talk to the baby. They'd talk to me about little bitty things, but then they'd leave me with something really important. This one that just knocked me loose. They were out digging roots, and they come back and kitchy-cooed and all that stuff.
Huh.
And this old lady, she said, we better get back to work. We're not just digging roots. We're planting dreams. And that just stuck to me ever since. I was hanging in a cradle, blowing in the wind. And they said it in the old language, not English, because they couldn't speak English, these old-timers. They wouldn't ever, they could. I don't sometimes, even if I can. But that's just a way knowledge and wisdom comes. Just flicks and jabs and sparks and beautiful wonder.
And you took it in like a sieve. And to bring up, to talk a bit about the dream and the importance of dreaming as a form of the beginning stage of creation.
Well, this entire universe, if anybody goes outside and the clouds are not there, and look up into the universe and look past the universe, and you see another universe, and look past that one, and you see another one. In the old way, that's Kinemumwa. Kinemumwa. Wherever, forever ends, Kinemumwa begins. And that's where all of our roots are. Everybody came from there to come here. And we all passed through the stars. And we all were gifted with dreams and songs. Everyone. I mean, a lot of it gets pared away now as you're growing up. You got to go to college. You got to go to high school. You got to read a book. You got to watch TV. You got to write the right channel. A lot of things get pared away. But everybody is
educated.
A dreamer and a singer.
That form.
everybody is a dreamer and a singer, and it's so important and so valuable, because when you go out and look up at the universe and look across at the universe, wherever you are looking at the universe, you see such a depth there. It makes you really wonder about how could I be alive? What did I do special so I could be alive? I must have done something. But if you look back into what you did, you didn't do anything. You were dreamed into being. You were changed into dream form in the land beyond the stars. Mm-hmm. And we passed through the stars, many changes to arrive here. We had to change to stay here. And that's what we're doing now. Now we've got to change to continue to the next part of the journey. That next part of the journey is easy. It's on just this side of the Milky Way. Boom, we'll be there one day really soon. Mm-hmm. The journey of life is like a dream. It's not like a dream. It is a dream. Mm-hmm. It's never ending. Mm-hmm. Dreams don't end. Dreams mature and make you very happy sometimes, and sometimes make you sad, but all in all, dreams are absolute, maybe harder than steel when it comes to measuring something for hardness and lasting power. And somebody out there, start dreaming because it's important.
Tell us about, you mentioned everyone's a dreamer and a singer, and mm-hmm. I hear the title for your next book in there somewhere, and everything you're saying, but tell us about the connection between dreaming and singing, because I know that's a major part of the book.
There is no connection. They're the same. In the very, very, very first moment of anything, there was voice. And for a million years, voice wanted to change to be something beautiful. Voice said, if I'm in this vastness by myself, I think I should be beautiful. So worked on that angle. Mm-hmm. So voice turned into song. And the very first, this earth, in the very first moment that this earth was thought of, it was in dream form. The earth was dreamed and sung into being. And the first one to sing it into being is Silver Gray Fox, and he was playing a flute when he was singing. And he dreamed a dream. And he sang until that dream appeared. And here we are again. That's all I know about that.
Well, I think he keeps singing and keeps playing.
Yes, because we're still here.
And we saw him this weekend in the Sierras. He came out and danced in front of us. I told you in the email.
Gray Silver Fox.
I'd never seen Gray Silver Fox before. But I start working with Babe, and he comes and pays a visit.
Yeah, I was fortunate to go up to Mount Shasta this weekend, and you shared with me some of the language to speak to the mountain and your name. And truly, we felt enveloped with an amazing sense of love and power due to the language.
Yeah, but the power of language to the mountain is something that nobody can measure. All you can do is appreciate it, mm-hmm. as the mountain appreciates you talking.
And
not using a strange language, a foreign language. There are foreign languages that dominate the earth, but they don't dominate the wonder and the beauty. They're here in all the school books and on TV day in and day out. Spanish, English, and driving everybody apart, trying to get us together. But it doesn't work. But when you talk to the mountain in the old language, the mountain says, "Oh, I didn't hear that for a long time. I better check this out." And it does.
It does. Mm. The wind picked up. And when we went back to the spot where we originally spoke, the same thing happened. There was a resonance, a memory that was there on the land. I was amazed because we were talking about something else on our way down. And then I felt, after sharing what you had shared with me on the mountain, I felt glued there for a while.
What kind of a feeling did you get?
It was a feeling of great, great peace and sudden understanding. And if you can believe it, the mountain suddenly opened up. I could see outlines of beings in the, what they look like, cathedrals in the mountain, and faces. And I, then suddenly birds, flickers, were singing. It just spoke. And I just had insight. It was as if I could see what had been there before, as if it was showing me too. I had to sit down and just be with it. It was a lot. But very, more than anything, a real sense of peace. The thoughts I had at that moment disappeared. There was a real slowing down.
The importance then of language was that the mountain recognized you then and made contact with you. And you can imagine how many million people every year just stop on the side of the road, crank up their cameras.
We saw that.
And the mountain has to view them as tourists or strangers or something. But when you speak the language, and the mountain says, "Okay, there's my people. Where you been?" So
I told her I knew you, truly.
Babe, I have a question about your own life and part of what's in the story. You speak about going through a period that I think any Native person struggling with the educational system in the United States has had to go through, where there's that point where you're struggling to remember and recall the true wisdom that you've been given by your elders, but the educational system is outright trying to erase that from you altogether. Now, what I've seen, I have not seen anyone who has been able to really flourish in that system without somehow buying part of the lie, kind of forgetting or thinking, hey, maybe this that I learned before is, you know, is myth, you know, or is somehow not as true as this knowledge that I've now gained in university. But what I've seen in your writing is that you have simultaneously become an expert at the English language and at teaching through the English language. Although you may not see it as much as everyone who listens to you, we see, and I think it's a common thing that we don't understand about the eloquence of Chief Joseph, for example, or the eloquence of Chief Seattle. How was it that you were able to go through the education and successfully complete it and yet still never doubt or never leave the truth of your ancient heritage?
Great question.
Well, first of all, the ancient is a part of me. It's not separate from me. But I went into the higher education deliberately. The old tribal council didn't command me, didn't order me, didn't give me money or support me in any way. Couldn't, because they didn't have any way to support. But they told me that I had to go back to college And I had to learn how to use words like bullets, because that's the way America uses words against us. And the longer I was in the university system, the longer I really realized how important it, the message was the old people gave to me. So I had a mission to begin with, which probably helped shed some of that off like water on a duck. A lot of it went off like a water on a duck.
He was ready.
A lot of it stuck, too. But that's why I got through it.
Janae and I are laughing because we know some of the stories. Those of you who are going to have the pleasure of reading the stories will understand the water off the duck's back.
You did it so beautifully.
Oh, is that okay?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm still in amazement when someone is able to deal not only with all of the normal difficulties presented by modern life, but the story of having, you know, an original worldview that was completely, that someone attempted to take from you, but they weren't able to. This society and the institution did everything in its power to strip the awareness of all of that as well as it could, but it didn't work.
And you spoke about that last week in tribal treason and cultural sedition, that many did succumb, but you had an inner strength and grasp of who you are.
Hang on sometime. But, and I just, I really feel so very lucky that the old people took enough notice to me to tell me these things.
At a young age.
And again and again. I didn't hear them again and again and again in the same quarter like a college.
Right.
I heard them over a period of 10 to 20 years. That story again. And why is it coming to me? Why? It was to pass it to somebody else. Because a lot of people need wisdom and knowledge and experience now. More than ever.
More than ever.
And I just wanted to talk about the college thing for a second. I really was hesitant to go into college. Matter of fact, I was at UC Davis. And the first month, I loaded up the kids, loaded up my pickup, and went home.
Oh.
And I thought, I'll slip in and nobody will see me. And I'll slip back under the trees and nobody will see me. I won't come out in a couple of years.
You didn't care but, for it the first few days.
But I, like they wouldn't notice.
I was had to eat.
Oh, sorry.
I went to a little grocery store and there was one of the people sitting in council who sent me to college to learn how to use words like bullets.
What are you doing
first one I ran into. One I didn't want to see. Right. I had to hide in a rock or something. And she walked up to me and her long strands of hair was kind of sticking out. I said, holy cow, what is going to happen to me now? And she put her finger right under my nose and she said, young man, you are not supposed to be here. Of course, she meant I was supposed to be at the college learning something. So I had to go, and that kind of... I slipped away another time, but I got sent back. So I thought I better stay, because maybe it was important. And maybe it was important. But the university experience left me a shallow feeling all the way through, because when I was in high school, a freshman in high school, and it was summertime, and all of us brothers and cousins about the same age get together and just run all summer, just sleep under a rock or on the top of a rock or eat pine nuts and roots and fish if we could catch them.
before the fences.
Run down to the road, see if somebody ran over a rabbit, take him and roast him. We didn't need a place to live. We just lived and ran and lived and ran. But my old auntie, her name is Gladys O'Neill, Fall River Mills, she made the best wahatch. Mm-hmm. Wahatch is a form of kind of a bread, a thick tortilla type of thing.
And wild plum jelly.
It's originally cooked on a hot rock. It's just water and salt mixed together and cooked on a hot rock. And that was what made our people survive in the removal days. And there were a lot of removal days in the home country. But old Aunt Gladys, she told me, she'd tell me about the Constitution. And she'd tell me how it was made. And she'd lecture me and my brothers, cousins, sometimes before we could eat, because we went to one of our places to eat, for sure. If we were ready to die, we'd run for the auntie's house. We get to Andy's house, ready to die. She got the food all cooked, but we have to have a lecture. And she'd lecture and lecture us. And every time she talked about the Constitution, she had lost her last word, was beware. Beware. So I went to this university thing full of beware on my toes. Worried about what was going to stick and what shouldn't stick and what might stick and how do I get it off if it's not supposed to be there. So I went with that cautious attitude to many classes and the college level, and there's a requirement to take a thing called American Indian Law. So I read the outline. There was one little paragraph outline of the class, but it offers what you should get in the end. I read that, and I beware was somewhere coming to me. I signed up for that class anyhow, and I went to class, and I thought the way it was described on the syllabus and that one paragraph of what we expect in class, I thought to myself, this will really be good because it'll be about the laws of the local people, the Tohono O'odham in Tucson, Tucson area, the Tohono O'odham, the Hualpai, the Apaches, the Comanche.
Makes
all
sense.
Those people,
you would think.
All around, I thought I'd learn something about
their tribal
rules
law.
And their laws.
Yeah.
And then I could compare it with mine.
Yeah.
But it didn't work that way. It was United States Constitution, case law, somebody versus somebody, outcome, established it. And it just kept going like that. And I just almost screamed.
Dry.
And I never took another class in the law arena because of that. It doesn't teach anything about nativeness or humanness. It talks about somebody versus somebody in 1821.
So it talked more about conflict and how to control people.
Conflict?
So-and-so versus someone else.
Well, I think that
a case history, you know,
if you
Andrew
think the
Jackson
whole
versus
that creates a law,
Cherokee Nation, for instance, that's
and Andrew Jackson won.
That's really a good thing to really study in depth. Andrew Jackson versus the Cherokee Nation.
That's huge
because you know the Congress and the President said to treat the Cherokee people like they were people. And Andrew Jackson, that's where he made his greatness. I got to be president. Got to be on every $10 bill, $20 bill, $50 bill. I don't know how many bills he's on. I only see a one. Can't make a good judgment. But I know he's on a bill somewhere big in history. But classic that he had created is yet living in the political mentality of this country. He said, John Marshall, you know, John Marshall was the chief of the Supreme Court.
Justice.
Chief Justice, Supreme Court. He said, John Marshall made his decision, let him enforce it. And that's when he went south in Cherokees and Tuscarora and everybody he could round up to move to Oklahoma.
Trail of Tears.
The Trail of Tears.
It, part of the irony, too, of the Cherokee Nation was that they had been the nation that had most tried to adopt the Western ways.
The five civilized
but
tribes.
The falsehood behind the legality, behind the whole argument that was made in Andrew Jackson versus Cherokee Nation, is that somehow they were more a people because they tried to be more like Western. They developed schools, buildings, they had their language.
Their own language written.
Developed writing.
Yeah. But the irony is that in the same argument that tries to give them rights, they are disenfranchised of their rights. Because instead of acknowledging, no, they are here, they are present, they are human, therefore they have the rights
and
as guaranteed.
They adopted agriculture.
Right. But instead, there is this argument that has become pernicious legally that their value or their worth as people or as legal entities has to be proven rather than the rest of the constitutional guarantees which are supposedly inherent in that we are here. And what people don't realize is that the nations, the other nations of the United States, the nations within, were not defeated. They were dealt with on a treaty basis, which meant they were dealt as independent nations. And when we're talking with Babe right now, we are talking of a citizen who grew up in an independent nation. And so the irony that we may think is in our history books, because on the East Coast it happened 120 years ago, and so the laws that the irony of the justice system and the laws is that they believe that precedent establishes everything. When in reality, it's precedent is kind of an illusion. You know, it was what they best
it's what's
thought back
convenient
then,
right? And what they want to see.
And Babe now, for him, that is the reality of life now, not in the history books.
Yeah,
being
he's
disenfranchised from an independent nation, an independent state.
And you just made reference to that, too. You said that your relatives were taken from their homeland.
You know,
it's
right
your trail of
exactly
tears.
Today, right this minute, right here. I am incompetent. According to the rules of America, Native people are born incompetent, unable to think. Somebody else has to think for us, unable to do something. Somebody else has to do it, like we're really feeble. Can't hunt, can't fish, they could never do those things. We had to teach them. If you read anthropology long enough, you'll find out that Christopher Columbus brought everything here on two or three ships. It was just a vast emptiness out here, and everybody was just kind of starving and not knowing what to do. And here he came and saved everybody.
They ate a lot better than we these days.
And anyhow, that's just not true. But to continue on that, in that mentality, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, for instance, has me listed as incompetent until I go down and take a test. But I'm not going to give them the pleasure to give me a test.
No.
I know I'm not.
Because then you just right, and you justify they're even asking that.
Exactly. Yes.
They want to have a piece of paper.
Jump over how many hoops?
We got
here.
Him. He gave in to our rule, and we got him.
And some innocently do, but you've navigated these laws that you're now forced to live under that are contrary to your system of values.
It's been
and you write about the struggle.
It's been a crooked trail ever since.
Yeah.
Well, it was probably not before Columbus, but after Columbus, for sure, it's been a very crooked trail.
Here's the first.
An awful lot of adjustments, a lot of mutation, a lot of, you know, it takes an awful lot to survive in this great place called America. If you're not supposed to be here, and America thinks we're not supposed to be here, we're strangers, we're out of place. Look at right now, they're building fences and putting machine guns all over the Mexican-California border, Texas border, trying to keep aliens out.
I know. And then bring in more arms to help the Mexican government in their fighting against
the
drugs.
Old people,
they don't want them there.
The old people said it like this. That one thought. One dream, one mind, one heart, one people, from the tip to the circle, the tip of South America to the North Pole Circle, one people. And we are the same people. They speak Spanish, what makes me more different because I speak English, but I'm just as much of stranger as there's people coming from Mexico.
Yep.
You can tell by the police looking at you when you go down the road. There they go.
You're quite right. You're
and,
a suspect.
Almost as much a stranger as the people who came from Europe.
I didn't hear that.
I said almost as strange as the people who came from Europe.
Yes.
That yeah, populated so freedom. Rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And aggressively. And you write about democracy and apartheid.
I think
that's what
something that you were talking about, the mountain, and what you've shown me too about mountain lion and other guides. There is something here in the land, and I think it is the whole world that claims its children. Any of us who are willing to be aware of who our parents really are can go out, and if your heart is open and you find the truest way that speaks to your own spirit, that the land will claim you.
Yeah, and it does.
I know
that's
that
well
Babe
said. That's exactly
has
happens.
Shown the way for many people who can read his words and who open their heart to understand that there is a primal vibration that is beyond any language, because that's what I think touched people in the words of what we think of the great Native American orators.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the language that they used. It was that they spoke a deep truth.
Yeah, they
so
lived it.
Even if they used halting English to speak this great truth, people heard it. And I hear it
they felt
every
it.
Day from Babe.
Yeah, me too. And it's rare, all too rare.
That's why the mountain was dancing for you.
I know, because you gave me those words in your language. And you spoke about your student who felt that she had a hole in her heart.
She's right here in Santa Cruz. Matter of fact, she'll be visiting me, I think, in about 3 days.
Oh.
It's that one student was in a class run by Stan Rushworth at Cabrillo College. And it was a Native American literature class, and I went over there to talk entertain, talk with people, and give it a little bit of a lecture. And there's one student just stood up and asked me if I had a big hole in here. She said, I have a big hole in here. Mm-hmm. And the weather people have that big hole in here. What is it? And if you had one, how did you get rid of it? What'd you do? I didn't have a big hole because the big hole I know now is created by a conflicting thing. This is knowledge, and this is knowledge, but they annul each other inside of the student. So the student gets nothing from two separate classes of paying for it and sitting there. They get nothing.
It's disjointed.
And you look at history, probably is the one of the worst possible subjects anybody could take looking for truth. Because old Harry Truman, I think some of you remember him, in 1849, he said, history is a pack of lies mutually agreed upon. And if you look at history, you're sure, at least from where I'm standing, there sure is a lot of truth in what O'Hare said at that time.
Yeah.
Beware, beware.
As your Aunt Gladys said as well, before you went to school, constantly beware. What I love about Two Moon 2 is that you, as I was reading it, I felt so present in what you were sharing, your reality. And I've had that open feeling in my heart too, that longing. And you brought the natural world and the cosmos together very naturally.
Well, because we're not separated.
I know, and that's why that hole was being...
A big soap bubble. Let's say there's a big soap bubble. And you could take a little bitty tweezer, and you could pull out one piece, and the soap bubble wouldn't burst or anything. That little piece is one of us. Yeah. That's how small we are.
Yeah.
But
you can follow it to another place of connection.
All a part of a great... That's why when they talk, old-timers talk, say, to the universe at dawn, they say, Oponaha. Mm-hmm. Oponaha. Like talking to the mountain, you're talking to the universe. Oponaha means great power, great spirit, great wonder, great mystery. Amemu Ishii. We are your little children.
Oponaha?
Oponaha. Mimu Ishii.
Oponaha.
Mimu Ishii.
We are your little children.
Oponaha. Mimu Ishii.
And in this instance, in the Lumquatmi means our hearts belong to you. So that's how you talk to the universe in the morning. And we're all a part of it. I mean, we're not, can't be separate from it. Some, there's a lot of things going on around that say, oh, we're strangers, we're separate from this, and somebody came from Mars over there, and all these different kind of things. Try to piece together existence, and they don't even know how they're here.
So that's a direct connection. Almost, I don't want to say pin code, but it's a direct connection with the language. The sacred word, the way it's spoken. English, just speaking it, it's all I know. When I shared what little I did on the mountain, I felt the difference in my language. It felt generic suddenly.
Well, you look at the Milky Way on some clear morning and say, Oponaha. And you watch a ripple run right through the Milky Way as it's going down over the hill. It's amazing.
I bet. I don't.
Thought was the first thing in the universe, and thought is a very powerful thing that we all have. Not very many people use it, but we all have a thought, and that thought is a part of the very first thought that started this whole thing long ago, that started as a dream. I mean, I know the Big Bang Theory. I watch those people and wonder, they're getting paid for being stupid and staying there. I wish to give him 5 more million.
Where did they get that from?
That's what happened to scientists.
Like the Bering Strait.
But we're all a part of a dream, and we're here, and we're part of the universe. The universe is a dream. The first thing there ever was is thought. The thought is so extremely powerful when you put it. An old-timer said, be careful what you think.
Well, you know, and I have to say that that power actually brought us on the air today, because there was something that happened that I couldn't trace, where you sent me, started sending me message about, okay, we're going to go on the radio, right? But we actually hadn't discussed it. I'd listened to you on the radio last time.
And
what I gathered since is that there was, I didn't know about it, but there was a discussion about coming back.
Yes.
So I just happened to be in town in time, not only to be here, but also just finished with everything, right when I got the call from you that Theo couldn't bring you here, that somehow everything got us here on time and Daryl safely into the studio.
Perfect.
Babe was... we were ahead of time, and if there wasn't some kind of dream happening that brought that all together.
Well, my thought was very strong. We're going to be able powerful to complete this.
Beautiful,
all three
dream
of us,
maybe
Malachi. And on this note, we're going to have to end. We're going to have to wrap it up. These hours go by so fast. We're going to have to have you on for 2, and then open up the phones for questions the next time. But I just want to go over your website again, and people can connect with you there.
Hey Dootsie La.
I wanted to let people know that Two Moon will be available on Amazon in November.
Great.
So we're going to send out a little mailing. We'll give us some information to you.
And you can talk about that some more,
and
for
so,
sure.
Yeah, and we're going to have an event in downtown Santa Cruz celebrating it coming out, too. So,
look at there. I'm going to be published in November. Remember, my editor is sitting at home waiting for me.
He is?
Today, she's there.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. I know you were waiting for her last week.
Mm-hmm. She's already read it, and she put a little note at the bottom. Wow.
Yeah, I know. I know. That was how I felt. It doesn't matter where I open up in the book, but it is riveting. It gives me...
It's really going to be a beautiful edition, too. It's going to be a very beautiful book, I think, honoring Babe and his work.
It certainly is.
Very special to work on.
We're so fortunate to have you here
in Santa Cruz. I think
access
that
to
was another part of the dream.
Communicate.
Yeah.
We worked hard to bring you here, I know.
Yes.
Some people did, Barbara.
Can I say hi to everybody out there in Santa Cruz or within range?
And do you want to spell Hayditsula once more? H-A-Y.
Hey.
Hey.
Dootsie.
D-U-T-S-I. Hey Dootsie.
La.
Hey, H-A-Y. D-U-T-S-I. L-A.
Hey Dootsie La.
Hey Dootsie La. Thank you.
Thought polishing. Outcome of thought polished.
Mm-hmm. And you will be thrown into the truth of the universe. That's what's happened to me. We're very fortunate. Thank you again. And thank you, Mark and Malachi.
Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you. And
thanks again to Radio Free Santa Cruz. Keeping the waves, the last bastion of truth on the airwaves.
That's for sure. And we're looking
for
donations,
us.
And you can mail those to FRSC P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz 95061. And I'm going to play a little bit of Lakesh, and then we're going to be speaking with Julia Witte. She's the environmental correspondent for Mother Jones, about the truth behind the Gulf oil disaster. So stay tuned. With your little fake Manhattan Bill community group, Ivy League, real estate firms have cut off the lane.
Someone to save you.
Okay, this is Janaea, and you're listening to Tickling the Belly of the Beast from the heartland of Santa Cruz. And our next guest is Julia Witte. I'm real excited about having her on. And she's going to be talking with us about the truth behind the Gulf oil disaster. Before I put her on, I just want you to know a little bit about her. She's a former filmmaker. Her more than 70 nature documentaries, they aired on PBS Nature, the Discovery Channel, National Geographic, Outdoor Life Channel, Arts and Entertainment, and many other broadcasters worldwide. And she also is the environmental correspondent for Mother Jones and a blogger at the Blue Marble and the Deep Blue Home. And she wrote an amazing article, which is why I have her on the radio, on October's issue of Mother Jones. And it's entitled BP's Deep Secrets. And she also explores the depths of the ocean, which I'm going to have her talk about. And she recently published Deep Blue Home, An Intimate Ecology of Our Wild Ocean. She's going to be speaking with us about that as well. Before I say much more, I want to put her on. Julie, are you with us?
Yes. Hi, Janaea.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you for coming on.
And first of all, I'd like to ask you a little bit about the deep sea and the life down there that we know so little about.
Well, there's so much more that lives down the deep than lives at the surface. So even though we think the surface waters might be very rich, we know that the largest biomass of life on Earth lives in the deep ocean, and not on the seafloor, but in the open water column. And it's a very large community of life, many, many species of fish and squid and all kinds of invertebrates. And this gigantic community of life is referred to as the deep scattering layer. And that's a leftover from its early discovery by oceanographers who were trying to map the seafloor. And they found this mysterious sea bottom that was measured at about 3,300 feet deep during the daytime and then rose to 1,000 feet deep at night. They didn't understand that this was actually the twice daily vertical migration of this enormous community of life called the deep scattering layer. Most of what we know and love from the surface ocean, the whales and dolphins and seals and sea lions and seabirds, actually dive down to feed on the deep scattering layer, most of them as in the nighttime, as that deep scattering layer rises up towards the surface.
And you write about that so well in the article, and how precarious their existence is now since the BP oil disaster and the catastrophic effects of this gigantic oil spill. And then, of course, the dispersant that was put in the water as well, so that it would go into the depths of the ocean.
Yes, in fact, this community, I happen to be working on an article about this deep scattering layer and this community of life at the time that the disaster in the Gulf of Mexico happened. So I was working with scientists off Hawaii who are using some really interesting new technologies, non-invasive technologies, to study the movements of the deep scattering layer and the ecology of the deep scattering layer. They're using sound to give us the ability to see underwater at night. And what they're seeing is incredible.
That's fascinating.
It is fascinating.
Wow.
And what I realized as I began to hear about the Gulf was that the use of chemical dispersants to disperse the oil way down on the seafloor was going to terribly impact this deep scattering layer of life.
So you knew at that point what had happened, the impact.
Well, I suspected that the minute I realized that they were dispersing the oil on the seafloor 5,000 feet down, I became alarmed, as did many people who, first of all, no toxicological studies really had been done on those chemical dispersants. Why BP had free rein to just use those things, you know, it took a really long time for the company that makes those dispersants to come forth and actually tell what was in them, tell the recipe, so that anyone actually could do any studies on them. I did, in my book, Deep Blue Home, interestingly, I had written about Canadian studies that were done on exactly those dispersants in the 1980s on seabirds off the northeast, the maritime provinces of Newfoundland and that region. And there were studies done, they were actually experimental studies done on seabirds where they were exposing
experimental
seabirds.
Oh.
Yeah, to both oil and the Corexit, the
same dispersant that BP
was using.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And what were the results?
Those findings. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask you what the findings were.
Well, the findings were very interesting, and they found that, you know, they were giving sublethal doses of oil and dispersant to these nesting seabirds and measuring the effect on the breeding success. And what they found, obviously, was none of these were theoretically high enough doses to kill the adult birds, although they definitely killed, they resulted in the death of the chicks or the eggs. Mm. But what they found was that even at sublethal doses, many fewer of those birds that had been exposed to oil and Corexit returned the following year to breed, which implied that their part had proved lethal after all. And that exposure, although it may not have killed them initially mm-hmm. for reasons we don't really understand, it killed them sometime in the next year.
Yeah.
Wow. So this is part of the sad story that,
yeah,
you know, even as the government is basically pushing very hard to have us believe that the troubles are all over down there,
yeah.
scientists and others recognize that this story is going to be unfolding for years, if not yeah. decades.
Yeah. And you write about it being a hospice, basically, for marine wildlife. And it truly
yes.
is. And as much as they try to cover it up through the media and controlling the fishermen and what they can say and the restaurateurs and just the population down there, striking fear on them for speaking out and keeping them employed to do nothing.
Yeah, there was very
their
much
complicity.
Of a sense. Yeah. I mean, I certainly had the sense in moving through the marshlands, the beautiful, lovely marshlands of southern Louisiana. I mean, just some of the most idyllic, beautiful, incredibly full of wildlife world that you could ever hope to see. And yet, most everything I felt was dead or dying, and it was that sense of the hospice wilderness I talked about in the article. And then...
Yes.
Yeah, and then I also wrote about the fact that the fishermen, and how BP really, in the period that I was there, which was in the weeks following the blowout of the well, they were making a huge effort to make it really hard for any reporters or media to get down into the area of the spill. And one of the things they did was they hired all the fishermen.
Mm-hmm.
They made them sign non-disclosure agreements so that they would not talk to the press.
Mm-hmm.
They hired their boats and then kept them moored offshore so that no one could even find them and talk to them. And they made sure that no one could find a boat to go out on and find any oil. They hired up all the hotel rooms. They hired up all the rental cars. And literally the whole time I was down there, I was having to stay in New Orleans, which was hours away. I would have to drive hours in both directions every day just to get out to the coastline, and it was a very effective strategy.
It was, and the lengths that they went to and the expense to cover up the true extent of the disaster, phenomenal.
Yeah.
And what's so sad, too, in the article, you talk about the boats that the dolphins used to follow for fish were now following boats with what is the name of the dispersant, Corexit?
Yeah.
And they couldn't see
yeah.
Corexit. And they couldn't see because their eyes were coated with oil. How tragic. And that's all they've known. And that is their territory. They can't go anywhere else. Dolphins and many other birds and fish. And the methane. And the methanol that was put into the water as a result of the methane. Another toxic ingredient, a soup of toxicity.
Yeah, all of that. I mean, certainly in my Mother Jones article, I which is in the current issue, I talk a lot about it, how much more the problem was than just oil. About 40% of what was spewing from the wellhead was methane, which is the primary component of natural gas. And in the following weeks, researchers who were studying the levels of methane in the water of the Gulf of Mexico were finding methane levels 100,000 times higher than normal, and down very deep, down thousands of feet deep, they were finding this. So this was unusual. One would have expected this methane, being a gas and being lighter, to have risen up and escaped into the atmosphere, which is usually what happens from methane that dissolves out from the ocean floor. But in fact, it wasn't doing that. They were finding that very little of it had escaped up into the atmosphere. Now, this is good news for the atmosphere because methane is a greenhouse gas. It's a very potent greenhouse gas. But it's bad news for the ocean in that although there are organisms, there are microbes that are evolved and adapted to living on methane, and they actually make their living with the energy of methane the way other microbes make their living from the energy of the sun, this was in effect creating a whole new region of the ocean that was now a methane dominant system versus what had been an oxygen dominant system. So there's a huge rearranging of who's living where and who's being affected by what.
So does this create the beginnings of a dead zone?
Well, it's not yet clear. I mean, the researchers I've spoken with have found low hypoxia levels out there in the region of these plumes of dispersed oil and dispersed gas.
That they were trying to hide for so long.
The government's been saying no, they're not finding low oxygen, but the researchers I'm talking with are saying yes, we are finding low oxygen. So the reason is that these microbes that feed on oil and even gas have a huge bloom, and they use up all the available oxygen in the water. So more than likely, that could be happening, at least in areas. But then interestingly, today I see in the news, in the science news, there's a researcher from Louisiana State University who flew over the Gulf very extensively in the past few days, and he found clearly what he's saying are subsurface plumes of oil that he could see from the air, and which he says will be still coming ashore in pulses with each kind of big wave event or storm event. So he says it's also far from gone from being a shore-based problem. It's certainly going to be a problem in the deep.
Oh, sure.
Where, you know, all these migrations, these vertical migrations and things are no doubt being disrupted by the presence of all this changed chemistry in the Gulf of Mexico.
And can you just say a little bit more about the vertical migrations?
Yeah, so these animals of the deep scattering layer, most of them, migrate twice a day. They migrate with nightfall towards the surface where they feed on animals and the phytoplankton and the phytoplankton-based food web of the surface. And then before sunrise, they migrate back down into the deep. So this enormous community of life lives below the cusp of perpetual darkness. They're always living in the dark. And that means they're migrating twice a day. Now, for some of the little teeny animals, some of the invertebrates of that community, they're migrating the human equivalent of 25 miles a day up to the surface and 25 miles a day back down into the deep. And they're using, you know, a huge amount of their daily energy budgets to make this migration. Obviously, it's important. The food sources at the surface are rich enough that it's worth it. But it also
survival.
Means that there's not a lot of, there's no fat in those energy budgets, which means if they don't get up to the surface in good time and feed for all the hours of night that are available, then they are going to weaken and maybe die. And if they are suddenly having to negotiate getting around plumes of dissolved gas and methane, or attempting to get around them, even assuming they have the ability to do that, and aren't just, in fact, trapped, either above or below.
Sure.
You know, then we're looking at animals becoming stressed out enough, threatened enough to, it, you know, have mortality events going on.
It's destroying nature as we know it and the ocean. It's...
Well, it's definitely rearranging it.
It's criminal.
Yeah, that's for sure.
It's intolerable for me to even fathom, and yet we have to. And many people have forgotten about it since the oil apparently has been capped. But this to me is still a major wake-up call and an opportunity for people to look at what we have done in the name of technology and cheap oil and gas. At what cost? I hope that hasn't been forgotten. I don't hear much in the news anymore. It's more whitewashing. And I think of those marshlands, and I remember reading something about them being burned, or that possibility, and now more oil coming up with the hurricanes and the waves. And that whole process is just beginning. And then the course of the Gulf, you wrote about that in your article, how it spreads throughout the oceans and into Europe, in the interconnection of the atmosphere and the oceans. I'm saying a lot here. Could you say a little bit about that, how this will be traveling, the oil, the soup, chemical soup?
Yeah.
And the ocean is chemical.
Yeah, I mean, everything in the ocean runs on chemistry, and so things move around to either seeking, those animals that can move seeking or staying with the chemistry that agrees with them, or they flee trying to get away from it if it changes. So we know, for instance, dead zones in the ocean, which are areas of low oxygen below which most life can survive. We know that the animals who can flee will leave those low oxygen waters in an attempt to get back into higher oxygen water areas. But many animals are stuck. They're stuck to the seafloor. They're stuck to reefs. They're stuck to, and they can't go anywhere, and they, of course, will just die. As to the fate of the poisons that are circulating in the Gulf now, we don't know, and most of the scientists that I've been dealing with readily admit that the rest of their careers will be spent examining this question, is what will become of all of these oil, methane, the drilling fluids, all of these things that have been used in and lost and, spewed out in the course of this disaster, and exactly how these are going to travel through the currents, whether they will escape the Gulf of Mexico and end up in the Atlantic. It's not known exactly yet. We'll only know in retrospect. We'll only know after it's happened what has become of this stuff. We can look at past disasters and understand something. I mean, we know that 21 years after the Exxon Valdez in Alaska, there's plenty of oil still up there in the environment. It's all over the place. It's just about an inch below the surface of the sand, or some very small number of inches below the sand. It's still trapped in rocky shorelines. We know that 40 years after a spill in Buzzard Bay off Cape Cod, that oil is still very prevalent. I think it was actually it might have been a diesel spill, but whatever it was, it's still very prevalent. And in fact, a recent studies done on it, it's the most studied spill of all times. And even 40 years later, it's still affecting the wildlife of that area. And animals that live in the part that still have the oil or the diesel or whatever it was are very impacted. A woman who recently published a paper on the fact that the crabs and things that live in that region, their reflexes are so slowed by the stupefying effects of this oil that it's as if they're drunk. They have extremely slowed reflexes and responses. So these things don't go away. They last a very long time in many environments. And we don't know, and we will not know. We cannot predict what will happen. Each of these events is unique. The Buzzards Bay one is different from Exxon Valdez, is different from the Gulf of Mexico.
In the Exxon Valdez, wasn't that a tanker?
Yes, that was a tanker.
Water exploration. That's fairly new. from what I understand. And how else does it differ from the Valdez?
Well, the important difference is, first, it was very deep. So, you know, it's at 5,000 feet that this problem originated versus basically on the shore. The other difference is it's the methane component. You know, there wasn't methane in the what spilled the crude oil that spilled out of the Exxon Valdez. Thirdly, it was not the Exxon Valdez was not hit with chemical dispersant in the deep the way this spill was. That's completely probably unprecedented, and maybe not. It certainly at that depth it is, and then the Gulf itself is a completely different environment. We have different organisms living in it. We have a different temperature regime. We have a different climate regime. So it's the response within the environment is going to be different. Now, in the long run, the Gulf may be, because of its warmer waters and warmer conditions, essentially the whole metabolism of the Gulf of Mexico, if you will allow that analogy, is much faster than the metabolism of the cold waters of Alaska. So that might be good news in the long run, in that the processes, in the end, the only thing that's going to fix all of the disaster of the Gulf of Mexico is nature. Nature's work itself, all these microbes who are going to feed on this oil, the methane, and even probably the dispersant. And, you know, the fact that the metabolism is faster running in the Gulf of Mexico means, you know, that possibly it'll mitigate, nature will mitigate the problem faster. On the other hand, it's a much bigger problem.
So, and it was already stressed, the Gulf of Mexico. You had written about that in your article, too, the climate change and...
Yes. Totally. I mean,
a huge dead zone already in the Gulf.
And yes, I'm.
And this on top of that, it's just immense, almost unfathomable. And the breeding grounds, you write about the terns. And where are these, where are they going to go?
Yeah.
I mean, they struggled so hard to bring life into the world amidst oil.
Yeah, you just wonder. It's a very, very sad reality that, the Gulf of Mexico was already a very stressed environment, and we had many species living there that are really barely hanging on to life. And this is the kind of scenario that undermines threatened species and can drive them over the edge into extinction, because it can be too much of a stressor added to all the other stressors that are already giving them huge cause for struggle. So we had, for instance, brown pelicans who had just recently been removed from the endangered species list, and they were hit very hard during their breeding season at a time when they're working overtime, not just to feed themselves, but to feed their chicks. And so the mortality in that breeding season is a very bad sign. We had we have a very small population of sperm whales who live in the Gulf of Mexico. They may very well never leave the Gulf of Mexico. They may, in fact, live in there all the time. And previous studies have been done estimating that as few as three deaths in that population of sperm whales from other than natural causes, from any kind of human cause, could doom the whole population.
There are that few. Wow.
Yeah, and their population dynamics are, you know, they breed late and they have very few young, so it doesn't take many in a small population where you can have, you know, very, very severe effects. We have...
Now, were they breeding at that time as well as the birds, the sperm dolphins?
The sperm whales are...
Sperm whales.
I don't believe... I don't think they have a definite breeding season, but they have young with them all the time.
Oh.
So the females and young who live in groups together and they will, you know, at any given time, they're like an elephant herd, really, if you want to think of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the wild herds of elephants, the females are always living with young of many ages, and this is more or less what sperm whale communities are like. So you have, we do know that they were feeding directly. Their favorite feeding place is a deep, the deep canyon, exactly where the Deepwater Horizon wellhead was.
Oh,
and
no.
We know that they dive in there into the deep scattering layer in search of squid and things, some of the squid that live in the deep scattering layer. So very unfortunate for them that that's still, and in fact, many people saw in the early days of the disaster, people flying over saw sperm whales swimming through thick, gunky oil.
Oh.
So we know that at least some of them have encountered it and were not able to get away from it. We did find there was one dead sperm whale found out there. Of course, you know, not everything is going to be found. So if deaths in deep water in the ocean are not, I'm sure much goes unseen.
And I had heard that BP was hiring people to take the animals away before the press could come in and document what had happened, too.
Absolutely. I encountered that myself in the early days.
Oh.
They were hiring the fishermen to bring in dead and dying animals. I heard, you know, it was impossible to get into the one facility they had set up in Louisiana for treating boiled animals. They wouldn't let any press anywhere near it. They had a complete lockdown on the situation there, and amazingly, no one was telling them not to do it.
Mm.
There was no one countering them. There was no government forces coming out and saying, "Hey, BP, why are you calling all of the shots down here?" I mean, Carl Safina, who I interviewed for the article in the current Mother Jones, he was the one who famously said, you know, why is BP running this problem? He said that's like putting the murderer in charge of the murder investigation.
I really hope we've learned something this time, but I don't know. I really don't. It's doubtful because not much is coming out anymore that I've been aware of. Your article just was a... I was very grateful to see it. Finally, something was being written again, and the truth. And I hope it's well publicized, and you're asked to come and speak in many places because your voice is needed. It was the missing link as far as I was concerned. And you write so eloquently about the three-dimensional underwater currents. You just spoke about that briefly. If you could go into that again. And the connection with the atmosphere and why the oceans are so vital to sustaining the planet. I didn't know that. I had an idea, but you explain it so succinctly and beautifully and poetically.
Well, thank you. My newest book, Deep Blue Home, An Intimate Ecology of Our Wild Ocean,
Yes. It's
a big focus of that book is I talk about the great ocean conveyor, as it's sometimes called, which is the movement of water around the world oceans. And, you know, we recognize different ocean basins. We've named them Pacific, Atlantic, and Indian Ocean, and so on. But, in fact, we now know from oceanographic studies that all the waters of the world are connected, such that, for instance, a drop of rain falling in the North Atlantic circulates not just through the surface waters of the Atlantic, but eventually sinks down deep and flows south and circles Antarctica and will reemerge in the North Pacific something like 1,600 years later. So the truth is the oceans, if you were to look at an exploded view of the oceans, it looks like, I describe it as a bunch of highway and highway interchanges with many different rivers of currents moving in different directions at different depths and at different velocities. And they're driven by the chemistry of the ocean, these rivers. They're driven by temperature and salinity, which affects the density of these discrete rivers of water within the ocean, and they're affected by gravity. So you have these movements on huge world ocean scale, very slow in some cases. A lot of the deep currents are very slow. But with them, we know now that much of our climate is driven by this ocean conveyor. And changes to the ocean conveyor at times when it's happened in the past have drastically affected our climate, everything from ice ages to extreme warming events to things like that. So the ocean not only moves, it tugs the atmosphere with it. So we have the ocean and the atmosphere are very connected. They are moving and affecting one another. Mm-hmm. In my book, I talk a lot about the ancients and their understanding of this connection, a lot of mythology, a lot of the ancient myths about ocean. People seem to understand that ocean and the atmosphere were connected. The ancient Greeks described Oceanus, the god of the ocean, as actually a great river that circled the world and was connected. It was a river of air and water, so somehow the Greeks knew this. So these are things we've known and forgotten somehow. You know, modern oceanography is only beginning to confirm some of
these. These were not myths. These were truisms.
They were. They were things that were intuited somehow by our ancestors across many spectra. I talk about similar understandings out of Indian Vedic mythology, out of Viking mythology. So really, many peoples of the world had an understanding and a knowledge of these systems.
I find that fascinating, and so do Native Americans here.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'm just curious, what can you, what did you, your book, I have not yet received it, unfortunately. It should be coming in the mail today. I look forward to reading it. But what did you say about the Nordic mythology?
Well, part of what I write about in the book, I write about the Canadian province of Newfoundland, where I spent some time. And so when I'm in, as I'm writing about Newfoundland, and I was filming up there some years ago, and I talk about the Viking, some of the Viking mythology, because the Vikings, we now know, actually did settle briefly in Newfoundland about the year 1000. Archaeological evidence, they have found a site up there in the northern part of the island of Newfoundland, where we know that there was a Viking settlement for only about 3 years, but and I talk a lot about the Viking myths of the ocean, and they also, one of their ocean gods, if you want to say, was, his name was Egger, and he was actually believed to be more ancient than the gods. In fact, and preceding the gods were the giants in Viking understanding of the world, and yet Egger was believed to be by some even more ancient than the giants. He wasn't. He was a primordial force whose beginning could not be known. And this is how the Vikings understood the power of the ocean over all of our lives.
Yeah. And that is a truth that I think we are just, you know it intimately because you've been a diver and you've explored it for, how long have you been exploring the ocean, actually?
And well, since I was a kid, really. You know, I dedicate book to my father, who taught me to sail, and my father was an Australian who grew up in the southern state of Tasmania, and he grew up sailing the Great Southern Ocean. Yeah, so he knew the some of the strongest sailing on Earth, and he, you know, I think he taught me a lot about the ocean, and then we spent summers when I was a kid, or our summer vacations on Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and
so
I grew up. I know we talked about that.
We
and I grew up playing on those miles and miles of sand flats at low tides, and exploring that great rhythm of the ocean as water comes and goes, and
with the crabs and the shellfish and the jellyfish and everything imaginable was in our backyard to play with.
It was.
So
it was
intimately explored.
Childhood.
I used to get up early in the morning and run down to the beach to go sailing with my father, too. I would be so excited and hopefully get stuck on a sandbar and wait for the tide to come in. So when this disaster happened, that's where my mind went. And a friend of mine said, well, if this had happened in Nantucket, you can bet something would be done. And I really began to wonder what could be done. In all honesty. And what hope do you have, or do you have any, for the outcome? Or what what could be done? Do you have any idea? What can we do to start healing our waters?
Mm-hmm.
That's a loaded question.
No, I think it's what we have to look at is how to avoid this in the future, and is this the opportunity for a course change, you know? I mean, we're all human society. We're sailing on a big, giant tanker that's really slow to turn around in the ocean, you know? It's incredibly hard to, you know, crank that helm over and get the thing to change course. But there are events that allow us to put in the effort to do that. And, you know, we know that in the aftermath of the 1969 oil spill in Santa Barbara, the shores of Santa Barbara, California said, no more oil drilling off here, you know?
Yep.
And a lot of other states went along with that. The reason, you know, Florida doesn't have any oil drilling off its coast, Florida was really upset when I was down there with Louisiana for having allowed it because, you know, they were in the war zone as a result of it, you know.
Yeah.
And after Exxon Valdez, you know, we took a look at the fact that what could we do to make those tankers a little bit safer than they were, and we put in laws to the effect of having to have these double-hulled tankers so that they would be a little bit more resistant to just bumping up against rock, okay? And now, 20 years after that, we have another opportunity. And, you know, I'm suggesting in my article in Mother Jones that this is an opportunity for us to look at the real costs of this so-called cheap oil.
Yeah.
And, you know, an opportunity to say, we know we have to change this energy paradigm. We know, first of all, that oil is a finite resource. For no other reason alone, we have got to figure out another way to get energy on this planet other than oil. We know it's incredibly dirty. It's filthy, and it's causing us tremendous problems with climate change already. So, you know, if ever there was a time to say, you know, why don't we pour some of those hundreds of millions and billions of dollars that are spent, you know, drilling exploratory wells, why can't we turn some of that money now into developing clean energy technologies?
Yes.
Scaled up to a part, you know, to a point where it's really going to be able to be implemented and put into play, which is something we have to do. And frankly,
the countries
that start to do that and get that going first are going to be the leaders of the world in the future. And I don't understand why the United States is dragging its feet on.
Well, I think that has something to do, that's another whole show unto itself, because it's a corporate culture right now that we're living in. And the bottom line seems to be profit, and we're fueled by oil.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to get around that still. I don't want to be resigned to that fact. I believe it can change, and I believe that it will, and I have a lot of hope in that direction. I'm working in my own life for that, but right now, unfortunately, this is a result of that corporate environment and milieu that we're living under. That's my feeling about it. But I'm encouraged by what you wrote too about harnessing the ocean as energy too. You wrote about a professor at the University of Hawaii, Luis Vega from Peru. And can you say a little bit about his work and how we can start harnessing the ocean in a sustainable way?
Yeah, well, as I said before, when the disaster in the Gulf happened, I was in Hawaii, and I was looking at researchers who were studying that deep scattering layer that I talked about. But I was also, that was actually part of a larger article that I was working on, looking at ways we could have a better relationship to the ocean in the future.
Oh.
And included in that article was, I was taking a look at some other ocean technologies that we have in a very early embryological form, sort of prototype technologies that might be scaled up for future use. And one of these that I wrote about in my article in Mother Jones is this ocean thermal energy conversion, which is known as OTEC, O-T-E-C.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been there's been a prototype up and running off and on in Hawaii since, I think, about the late 70s or the early 80s, and I interviewed Luis Vega, who was instrumental in that early on and has continued to be. And this is a form of energy, interestingly, that's gained from the same essential mechanism that the deep scattering layer animals use. So those animals make use of the temperature differential between the cold water of the deep and the warm water of the surface. And they're using it in that they are going down into the deep. And in some cases, they're spending their time, maybe the daytime hours down there, and it's cold enough that their metabolisms slow down, and they might even go into something approximating a torpor or a very short-lived hibernation. And that means they need, their metabolism slows enough that they need less energy to run it. And that is even, that's apparently an important, a good enough trade-off that it's worth that swimming the 25-mile human equivalent up to the surface and back again to feed. There's enough of an energy savings down there in the deep. And basically, ocean thermal energy conversion is finding a way for us to utilize that thermal differential between the cold water of the deep and the warmer water at the surface. Now, it's a complex process, which I would advise your listeners to go take a look at my article in Mother Jones, which is on their website. They can have a look at it on there, and it'll be a more interesting description of how it works. But it's a way of getting energy from the ocean in a pretty clean manner. And Luis Vega envisions a day. He's been thinking about this for decades and working on it for decades, and he talked about, you know, a future scenario where you might actually have these ships that would be moving around out in the ocean, running themselves on clean energy, and they would be moving around and harnessing that thermal differential, storing it as energy, and shipping that energy via some, you know, improved battery technology kind of a situation, or hydrogen cell back to Earth, back to the Earth. Almost Earth, back to the land, and you know, it could, it certainly would work early on, even at current technological abilities. Systems like this do provide energy in open, like Hawaii, where they have islands. They don't have a continental shelf. They have deep islands rising from the deep sea, and so the deep sea is very close to shore in Hawaii, you know? It's right there. You just go a mile or two offshore, and you've got very deep ocean water underneath you. Where we live on the continental shelf, you have to go further out, and this is why Luis Vega envisioned second or third generation of this technology, where you would have these movable ships out there that are harvesting the energy and shipping it back ashore via, you know, clean running ships. So,
and it sounds possible. It definitely does. It just needs some investment, some serious.
Well, as all of these do, you know.
Well, I hadn't heard of it before, and even considered the possibility. And go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
Just the possibility of that, and hopefully then that would allow people to start looking at how precious a resource, if they have to consider the ocean strictly a resource, it can be that as well.
Exactly, yeah.
And not constantly dumped upon in just considered, or not considered much at all.
Yeah, I talk about in my article for Mother Jones that, you know, what we really put at risk in this disaster in the Gulf of Mexico was the largest and richest, least explored, and least protected ecosystem left on Earth, and that's the deep
ocean.
Oh,
that's the truth. Oh, yes.
You know?
And you think of the marine life that's in there each day putting its life at risk just to survive. You write about the two edges there. And ours is done intentionally. Their life is very precarious to begin with.
Exactly. Exactly.
And then to make it that much more difficult, that's a crime. It really is. And just impacting our lives as well, of course, that goes without saying. But I think of the marshland, that's what we can actually see in the lives and the interconnections just there, let alone the surface of the water and then the deep sea. And the corals. Oh, you write a little bit about the coral life in the deep sea, not just the corals that we can see, but in the deeper layers that are being terribly impacted.
Yeah, there's there are obviously some coral reef communities. There's some cold, deep reef communities in the Gulf of Mexico. Those are ones that the researchers who know those areas are very concerned about what the effects of this catastrophe may be on those ecosystems. And again, the answers will not be known for years, if not decades, what the real impact of this enormous catastrophe will have been on these rich, rich parts of the Gulf of Mexico.
I know. I just wish there was a magic medicine that could float down from the heavens and heal it, but that's strictly a fantasy. And then there's so many other pipelines and wells that are there that haven't gone off yet, and hope they don't. And the abandoned ones as well. Oh.
Yeah, but I write about, there's 50,000 holes in the floor of the Gulf of Mexico.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Again, unfathomable.
It's a huge infrastructure that we've built. You know, we've invested everything in this one technology. And, you know, what we see in the Gulf of Mexico now is that in order to get this dirty, so-called cheap oil, you know, we're having to push technological frontiers, and we're pushing harder and faster, and we've basically moved out beyond our safety zone. And
yes.
The disaster proves this. Huh. We have the technology just barely to drill at these depths, but we don't have any technology to deal with the problems
with the cleanup.
That might arise.
No, and who would have guessed the disaster would be the extent that it was? And they didn't have the technology, and we relied to point blank about that. And didn't you say that one of the reasons they put the dispersant in and the methanol was because they would be accountable to how many gallons of oil actually spewed into the ocean? They tried by adding the methanol and the, if I'm getting this correctly, and the dispersant to conceal the number of gallons.
Yes, I mean, in the wake of the Exxon Valdez, laws were put into effect where
fines,
a company would be fined, I think, between $1,000 and $1,100 a barrel of oil spilled, and that would rise to $4,300 a barrel if it was proven to be caused by gross negligence. So if BP is found, if this disaster was, you know, in the courts found to be a result of gross negligence, then they are going to be liable on order of $20 billion. And they know that. And they've known that from the very, very beginning. And that's why I think they chose to disperse that oil at the wellhead when there's no known, you know, there's the known effects of that are basically none. And yet they were able to do that with any kind of an environmental impact statement, any assessment of what that might actually be all about. And also from a PR point of view, it was greatly to their advantage to keep that oil out there in the deep where we can't see it. Even now it's to their advantage, you know, to have relatively little of it coming ashore in that Exxon Valdez fashion, a big, thick, gunky, sludgy oil coming ashore.
Yeah.
There was relatively little of that because they were dispersing it. They were hitting it so hard with dispersing.
Yes, they were. And what's so beautiful about what you write is that you know the deep oceans well. You've been studying it. You know it intimately. You love it. So you can address it, the vulnerability of the oceans. And you're a real spokeswoman out there.
Well, speaking. Thank you. And I try.
You are. You really are. I hope you can come into Santa Cruz at some point and read from your latest book. And what is your website?
If you just Google my name, Julia Whitty, W-H-I-T-T-Y, you will find my website and my blog. And if you go to motherjones.com, you'll find my blog there at the Blue Marble, and you'll find my latest article called The BP Cover-Up.
Uh-huh. And that's the one that's in the October issue of Mother Jones.
Yes, it's in this current September-October issue.
Great, that keeps it simple, and I often do just Google a name, and I'm amazed at what I come up with. And certainly in your case, and I really want to thank you, Julia, for taking the time to come on Tickling the Belly of the Beast and share with us your wisdom and your knowledge, your intimate connection with the ocean.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate you giving the story this much time.
Oh,
thank you.
I'll do it again. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
All right, and now we have Palestinian news. Thank you, Julia.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate that.
You're welcome. And
bye-bye.
Thank you for all that you do. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, that was Julia Witte, and she is the environmental correspondent for Mother Jones and has written extensively about the Gulf oil disaster and BP's role in that and what we can do to begin to turn it around. And right now, as always, we have Palestinian news, hopefully. Let's see. Here we go. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Palestine Today, service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, September 8, 2010. Hamas warns the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah against arresting more of its members and decides to release 90 prisoners ahead of the Muslim holidays. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned.